Well, we could start by reviewing what we've studied in 3 John so far, but we haven't done anything. So we're going to get right into the book. A little bit of a rarity. Don't expect little treats like this all the time. But we're going to go right ahead into 1 John. We'll just go ahead and read the first couple verses, and that'll serve as something of an introduction to the book. Lloyd, could you go ahead and read that for us?
To my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well.
Okay, so a simple little greeting here. We have a letter from the Apostle John who refers to himself simply as the elder. Now, there were plenty of elders around in the church all the time. But the reason why he calls himself that is because this, like really all of the things that John wrote, all the inspired writings that John wrote, was written very, very late in his life. This was written AD 90 or perhaps a little after AD 90 when all the other apostles and everyone else from that early generation of Christians had pretty much passed from the scene. There are ancient sources from outside the Bible that suggest that John was around long after all the other apostles had passed away. And there's certainly a lot of things that you would think about a guy like John being that last link for that new generation, the last link to the lifetime of Jesus and all those great things that he saw. And so he could just call himself the elder, or it's actually literally it's just the old man, so it could be either interpreted as either one. He'd been around for a long time. One of the things that it comes out later in the epistle, and it's kind of unfortunate, is if you stop to think of what we think of John, as well as the other apostles, Peter and James and all those guys, we think about how wonderful they were, and we probably would think how encouraging it would be to have some of them around once in a while. You know, in John's own lifetime, late in his lifetime, about the time that he wrote this letter, he was not particularly respected by a lot of people in the church. There were a lot of people who admired him and loved him, but there were a lot of other people, influential people, who did not like him and who thought that he was an old fossil who had little relevance to the church anymore. The late first century AD, if you know your church history, is the time when it became more popular in the church to have stronger, more forceful leaders, the kind of leaders who like to tell people what to do, who like to boss people around. We'll meet one of these leaders down in verse 9 and 10 of 1 John, a man who had a very prominent position in his church and who didn't have much use for John. John was the kind of person who, late in his life, he took a lot of time to encourage people and to love people, and he told people a lot about Jesus, and there are some people who think that's wonderful, and there are other people who think that really isn't getting the job done. And so it's kind of a sad irony that we'll run into with John. John offers this little prayer for Gaius, his friend, and it's a simple prayer. He actually prays for two things. We always start off with one simple question, and then the rest of them I'm free to ask whatever tricky or difficult questions I can. What are the two things he prays for Gaius?
Good health.
Good health.
Good health. And what kind of health?
Physical.
Good physical health. And the other prayer is pretty much parallel.
Good spiritual health.
That's basically what he's praying for Gaius. And it's interesting because, you know, that really is a lot of the things we pray for each other is good physical health, good spiritual health. The interesting thing about this is if you go through this epistle, as we're going to go through verse by verse, you notice a couple of things. You notice that John really cares about his friend Gaius, and he cares about other people. It's one of the things we know about John. Remember when we've been studying John all these weeks, how does John refer to himself?
The disciple whom Jesus loved.
And John, for many centuries, has been nicknamed the apostle of love. Which there's a little bit of an irony about that if you remember earlier in the Gospels some of the things that characterized John. We'll take a peek at those a little bit farther along. So John is a very caring person, and one thing that he shows is his concern for friends like Gaius. It's very basic. I pray that you may enjoy good health, and I pray that your soul will keep getting along well. He doesn't make it complicated. He knows that there really is very little in life that's as important as spiritual health, and as even worldly people think, you know, if you're decent, halfway decent physical health, that's half the game or more right there. You got it made. It's not so important whether you have a lot of worldly goods or possessions or fame or anything like that. If you're in decent health and if your soul's getting along well, that's what he prays for his friend. Okay, that's a short introduction to the letter. Picking up here in verses 3 and 4, Dot, could you read verse 3 and 4 of 3 John? And then I'd like to take just by way of comparison, take a look at some verses in John's other epistles. Brenda, could you read, if you could back up to 1 John, and right after Dot reads from 3 John, could you just read chapter 1, verse 7 from 1 John? And then Norma, could you get...
I don't have it.
Okay.
I don't have my Bible.
Okay, well, we don't want, you were staring intently at something and I was sure it was a Bible, so that's fine. As long as it's not one of those little gizmos that other people are using to cheat on the trivia question, you can look at anything, that's fine.
First John?
Second John. I'd like you to do the one in 2 John 1, verse 4. Go ahead.
It gave me great joy to have some brothers come and tell me about your faithfulness to the truth and how you continue to walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth.
1 John 1:7. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, purifies us from all sin. 2 John 1:4. It has given me great joy to find that the children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us.
Thank you. I kind of messed my chalkboard up. I put the notes from this passage up there, so we're going to have to mix and match here. So that'll keep you awake this morning. Verse 3, he talks about faithfulness to the truth. He also has this phrase that you see not only in 3 John, but in the other two epistles. What's the phrase that pops up in all those passages that we listen to?
Walking in the light.
Walking. Walking in the light. Walking in the truth. And you know, this is one of John's favorite expressions. Walking in the light. Walking in the truth. This is kind of characterizes the things that he is sharing about. And again, it's worth reflecting, since we know that this letter was written so late in John's life. John's somebody who's seen it all. John's been around through the early days of Jesus' ministry when it was just getting started up. He went through the glory days when everybody loved Jesus and the miracles were attracting all that attention. He was there during the dark times when Jesus was crucified and everyone that followed him was afraid they were going to be executed as well. John was there for the excitement of Pentecost. He was there for the spread of the gospel. He's seen lots of people become Christians. He's seen lots of them fall away. He's seen lots of them stay faithful. He's seen lots of people be persecuted. He's been persecuted. He's seen it all. And yet his perspective on following Jesus remains very simple and very straightforward. There's no complicated theology. There's no fancy doctrines. There's certainly no bitterness or anger or fear that he tries to instill in anybody. He values this concept of walking in the light or walking in the truth more than anything else. He says, it gives me no greater joy than to know that someone like you, Gaius, my dear friend, my child, is walking in the truth. And he talks about how following Jesus, he always compares it to walking. Now, why would he compare it with walking? What are some of the other alternative verbs he could use here? Let's see. Running after Jesus or chasing after Jesus or racing around in Jesus, which a lot of people do. Or he could say lounging around in Jesus, which a lot of people do. Just kind of basking in the light instead of walking in the light. But he chooses walking. Walking is kind of the normal pace of life. Now I know we have some folks in here who like to run and get themselves all tired and everything, and that's not bad in its context. Personally, I make it kind of a policy not to run unless something carnivorous is chasing me. But there are times and places for running. If you're on third base and the guy hits a fly ball to the center fielder, you have to tag up and run home. If you walk, you're going to get thrown out. So understand, running has a place. But in following Jesus, the proper pace is walking in the light. In other words, just taking the normal day-to-day events of life and doing it in the light, staying in the light, staying in the truth, not trying to get ahead of Jesus, not lagging behind Jesus, just letting Jesus and the Spirit and the Father accompany you on your walk through life. It's a wonderful image, even though it's very simple. And John is someone that has been through so much tumult, and yet this is still to him the ideal. This is still what gives him no greater joy. Just to know that my old friend Gaius is back home. We don't even know where Gaius lived, and he's just walking along in the light. And that gave John a lot of joy. And he does give him this, it is kind of a constructive reminder from verse 4 here. When he says, I just have no greater joy than to hear my children are walking in the truth. That this is what he wants Gaius to remember. We don't know how old Gaius was. John calls him his child, so it's possible he was much younger, just starting out. Maybe Gaius hadn't been through all the events and all the turmoil that you can go through in the Christian life. And John simply reminds him, just keep walking in the light. Don't let all the commotion out there and all the arguments and everything bug you. Just keep walking in the light, and you're going to be okay. And as we get back into the text then, we see that Gaius has been involved in a ministry that John wants to single out to express how encouraged that he has been in this. Picking up here, chapter 1, in verse 5. Paula, have you got that? Could you read verses 5 to 6? And then, Larry, would you mind going 7 to 8 for us?
Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing to the brothers, even though they are strangers to you. They have told the church about your love. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God.
It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from pagans. We ought therefore to show hospitality to such men so that we may work together for the truth.
All right, thanks a lot. What we see here is what Gaius has been doing. What kind of impression do you get of Gaius? What kind of a church member is he? Leader or just some regular quote-unquote member? Can't really tell, can you?
No, you don't.
Don't really tell. Yeah, that's one. I warned you. There's trick questions in here. What's his
ministry?
Hospitality. Showing hospitality. And he's basically the kind of guy that invites people over to dinner or invites people to lunch, lets them know that he likes them, lets him know he cares about him. And John goes out of his way to express to Gaius how encouraging that this apostle finds this. Gaius is certainly a simple example of how friendship and ministry go together. And the word, the other word that comes to mind is this word fellowship. And if you look at the word fellowship, it actually is a good way of tying together the words friendship and ministry. If you look literally at the word fellowship, what does it mean? If you look literally at the word, what does it mean?
People on a boat.
Yeah. It's has to get it. Yeah, Lloyd has to get in with the pun. That's fine. I got to put up with them in my small group. So, fellowship. In other words, we have something. We're fellows. We have something in common. We're in something together that's presumably bigger than ourselves. And the reason why I point that out is because that's kind of the link that John's reminding us of between friendship and ministry. And really, most friendships, it's because you have something in common. Either you grew up in the same neighborhood and you have certain things in common, or you cheer for the same sports teams where you have something in common, or some such thing. Well, the link between friendship and ministry is realizing that this fellowship we have, something in common, is bigger than us. It's bigger than ourselves. It dwarfs our own personal interests and needs to the extent that we understand we have something that we can offer other people. And that's what Gaius is doing. And Gaius has chosen to do this by offering hospitality. And it's particularly interesting that who are these people that Gaius is going out of his way to show hospitality to?
Strangers.
They're strangers. John just calls them what? he calls them the brothers. It's kind of an expression. What this group probably was is some of the traveling preachers, not necessarily, the phrase he used could be, I think someone even said it, brothers and sisters. It would probably be both. Groups of traveling preachers or missionaries or whatever you'd like to call them that would kind of travel from city to city, see if there was a church there, see if they could help. And Gaius is simply going out of his way to show them hospitality, even though they're strangers to him. That's what John says. In other words, he's serving them not because they're his relatives or because he knows them. He's serving them out of his own faithfulness to Jesus and their faithfulness to Jesus. There's an automatic acceptance on Gaius's part. They're serving Jesus. I'm serving Jesus. His first response is to do what? Okay, this church back where you come from, does it have organs or anything? This church that sent you out, you do Sunday night and Wednesday night, right? Was that his first response? His first response. Well, what do you think about this doctrine over here? His first response was to do what? Hey, brothers. Hey, sisters. Let's spend some time together. In other words, there's plenty of time for all that stuff later, if and when it ever becomes appropriate. But John's first response is to do what? Let's establish the bonds of fellowship. And you may find when you do that you really never have a need to get around to the fussy stuff if you just understand that there are other people who are also faithful to Christ like you. These simple actions have some important truths. And he has this expression that the reason why John is so happy that Gaius is doing this, it's because Gaius is doing this for the same reason they're doing this. It says in verse 7, what was the reason why these brothers and sisters are out evangelizing? Verse 7. For the sake of the name. It is just an expression. In other words, they're doing it truly for Jesus. John knows that this group is a selfless group. They're doing it for the sake of the name. And why is Gaius going out of his way to show them hospitality? For the sake of the name, because they both belong to Christ, and that's a good enough reason for him to do something. And so John says, we ought to show hospitality for these men so that we can work together for the truth. Now, simple things here that Gaius, his whole ministry seems to be wrapped up in this hospitality. And so what does John say to Gaius about his own ministry and what he should be doing? This is not a trick. This is just maybe a little mental block that we have to overcome here. What does John say that Gaius ought to be doing? Yeah, just continue to do so. That's what he tells him to do. Gaius has found something to do to help people to see God's light a little bit. Gaius has found something to do that shows God's love to people a little bit. And John's recommendation to Gaius is to keep doing it. See, John doesn't say, you know, Gaius, those guys that you're showing hospitality to, you know, they're evangelizing people. So what about you, Gaius? You ever thought about maybe you ought to be doing a little bit about that yourself? He doesn't say to Gaius, you know, hey, it's nice that you're showing the hospitality and you're taking people into dinner, but how many people did you invite to church this week? How many people did you challenge on their false doctrines? How many people have you gotten involved in trying to do other stuff with them? He just says, Gaius, it is terrific that you found a ministry that serves people and that gives people. You see, there's all kinds of ministries that we're involved in, and it's natural for us to think of the church as an institution instead of as a body of fellowship and friendship. It's human nature to try to think in terms of structured programs and activities instead of just letting believers like Gaius find something to do. It's one of the things that we always have a tendency to do is to evaluate other Christians, to evaluate our congregation on our own expectations. What are we doing? What can I measure numerically? It's a human nature. Now, you may have noticed that Lucy, the Bible class goose, is back with us today, and that means we have a wildlife fact. Animals have responsibilities, too. One of the responsibilities that most animals have, and many of them take seriously, is to take care of their families. I mention this because Lucy is a goose, and geese are very widely known for the way that they protect their nests. During nesting season, the mama goose sits on the eggs, and what does the daddy goose do? He guards that nest. And what happens if you get a little too close to that nest? Yeah, the daddy goose channels the spirit of Alfred Hitchcock is what happens. Does his very best impression of Norman Bates. That's what happens. And they're very frightening. They can be very frightening. They really alarm people. Well, you all ground, the geese do that because they're ground nesting birds. Their web feet mean that they can't build nests in trees like perching birds do. They have to ground nest, so they've got to protect their nest in some way. There are lots of other birds that have to nest on the ground. Ducks nest on the ground too. Do ducks protect their nest the same way the geese do? You ever seen a duck rear up at you and flap its wings and try to hiss at you? You know the reason why they don't do that? Because it would look silly. Because ducks are too small to make that tactic work. Do you know what male ducks do to protect the females in their nest? Do you know what they do? Well, during nesting season, if you spend time around ducks, as I know very few of you do, but you'll see that during nesting season, you'll often see little groups of male ducks here and there making a lot of racket, splashing around, quacking at each other, doing what appears to be just playing a lot of games and chasing each other around. Why are they doing that? It's so that if a hungry predator comes into that territory, the hungry predator isn't going to bother to look for chicks and mothers. It's going to say, oh, bunch of goofball ducks playing around. There's an easy meal right here. And the predator will just chase the male ducks around, and the male ducks are risking their well-being so that these predators don't bother looking for the nest. It's a completely different way of protecting the nest.
The females are camouflaged.
The females are camouflaged, right. One of the things you'll notice is that male geese and female geese, they look the same. That's not true with ducks. Male ducks are much more brightly colored because they want to be ostentatious. They want to be seen. They want predators to see them. The female ducks are very drably colored. They're green and brown so that they blend in wherever they build their nests. And so that's the way the male ducks protect their nests. There are other ground nesting birds that have different tactics. A famous bird tactic is to pretend to be injured. A lot of birds protect their nests that if they see something coming, they wander away from the nest and pretend that they got a broken wing so that a predator will think that they're an easy meal and they'll chase it along. I read an article by a wildlife researcher once who saw a plover, it's a little shore bird kind of similar to a sandpiper. Saw this plover that looked like it had a hurt wing. And this kind-hearted wildlife researcher followed the plover. She was going to take it to a wildlife refuge and fix its wing. And it fluttered along on its little broken wing, and it hopped a little bit, and she followed it a little more, and it hopped a little bit more, and every time she'd get close, it'd pick up and flop a little bit and go a little bit farther. And after it went a few hundred yards, all of a sudden it was fine. It picked up and flew off. And this wildlife researcher remembered, wait a minute. That's what these characters do to guard their nest. And so she went back to where she had first seen the bird, and she found this really adorable little plover chick that she left alone. She took a picture of it first, but then she left it alone. See, all the different birds use different means of doing the same thing, protecting their nest. Can you imagine a mother duck complaining to her husband, how come you're not more aggressive like those geese? What's the matter with you? Those geese really intimidate those humans. What's the matter with you? Can you imagine a mommy goose criticizing her husband? What's the matter with you being so rude to those humans? Why can't you be like the ducks? Just splash around a little bit and distract people. Well, there's a lot of good ways of doing things that get the same thing done. There's a lot of good ways of showing people Jesus. Lots of real good ways of people showing Jesus. One good way is to sit down with the Bible and teach them about Jesus. Another good way is to show them hospitality. Another good way is to serve them. Another good way is to lift them up when they're struggling. Even if you think that they're goofing up, just to be gracious to them. Lots of good ways to show people Jesus. What does John recommend that his friend Gaius does with the way he's found to show people Jesus? Just keep doing it. See, he doesn't fuss or nag at Gaius about other stuff that he could be doing because Gaius has found something good to do. And John trusts his friend that this is what he's suited to do. Everyone's suited to serve Jesus in different ways. Some people are suited to teach, some people are suited to serve, and so on and so forth. If you look at a brother or sister and think that they're not doing anything, it probably reflects more on you than on them. It probably just means you haven't looked more closely at their life to see the ways that they're showing other people God's love and life. You know, we're told a lot of times in the Bible not to judge each other. And yet that's one of those verses that we kind of, oh, that was for back then. You know, there's a different policy in effect now. Even if all your brothers and sisters do is come and sit in class every week, just imagine what would happen See, I spend a couple hours a day working on this class when I'm teaching. Just imagine what would happen if nobody showed up. That's 2 hours a day I'd be out there causing trouble. So the people who just sit there and sit in my class are performing a valuable service. You know, they make me think that people are listening, and so I spend a couple hours a day not getting in trouble, getting the class ready. Really, the people who just come to church and worship with us, they are doing something valuable. They're being with the body. They're praising God. We should never denigrate anything that anyone else is doing for the sake of the name. Now, the irony is, there are people out there who are doing stuff that it may have some good effects, but a lot of times they're really bad examples in other ways. And that's where, if we get back to the text here, we're going to meet this character Diotrephes, picking up here in chapter 1, verse 9. Phil, why don't you read verse 9 and 10 for us?
I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves
you, should have known that was coming.
But Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. So if I come, I will call attention to what he's doing, gossiping maliciously about us. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church.
Here is an example of what I was telling you at the beginning of how, as shocking as it may seem to us, when John the Apostle was an old man and had been serving Jesus faithfully for all these years, almost 60 years probably, a lot of people really didn't think too much of him. This, can you imagine having John write to you, if you're some kind of church administrator or leader, and the Apostle John writes to you, I was thinking of coming by and visiting your church. What would you want to say? This is great. You know, you'd stay as long as you want. You know, you will, how often do you want to speak? Where would you like to stay? Well, this character Diotrephes, what does it say that his response was?
Don't you dare come by my
church. I don't want anything to do with you. It's kind of shocking. And of course, we can really have a good time criticizing this fake Diotrephes, because we never do that, do we? We're always very appreciative of people like John, aren't we? Well, what kind of a guy was Diotrephes? He was a take-charge kind of guy. He got stuff done, made the trains run on time. He set standards. Wasn't like that slacker John who just went around loving people and encouraging people. We can't have that in the church. We've got to have guys that can get things done, strong men, iron men, people who boss people around and tell them, you ought to be doing that, you ought to be doing that. Well, even though Diotrephes' own church seems to have felt that he made a pretty good leader, who's really the Christian example? Well, it's really John, isn't it? What does it say about Diotrephes that kind of sums him up? It says he loves
to be first.
And it goes on and it talks about he runs other people down. He manipulates people. He bosses people around. And you see, the sad thing is not just that there's a guy like Diotrephes, because just by himself, here again, we ought to be gracious to Diotrephes. He's got a problem. He doesn't know God very well. And he's just a sinner like any other sinner. You know what the real tragedy, though, here is? He's got a church full of people who are following his lead. He's got a church full of people who are confusing this bossy, self-assertive style of so-called leadership with spiritual leadership, just because he's getting stuff done and they like it. You see, it's human nature. If you think of this phrase, loves to be first, and you think of the things that go into that, you know, the human tendency to make comparisons or to compete, that's part of human nature. The human tendency to want to control what others think and do. Well, I think he ought to be doing that. I don't think they ought to think that. He shouldn't have said that. Here's all the reasons why you shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't listen to that guy over there. You know, the tendency to evaluate, to decide, well, I think you're doing okay in that area, but you could be improving in this area. All that is involved in loving to be first. You know, there's a part of our flesh that kind of admires that. There's a part of our flesh that finds that very hard to resist. And it's not just in the church. It's a human universal. And making comparisons and competing. You see it in all areas of life. It's the nature of this world that the prizes and treasures of this world, there's not enough to go around, and so people are always competing for them. And even when they're not competing for them themselves, it's human nature to think of life as competition. There are a lot of you who have been trained to boo and hiss when Charlie Darwin's name is mentioned, that natural selection, survival of the fittest. But then we kind of incorporate the same thing a lot of times into our church mentality. That it's about being first, it's about getting your way, it's about persuading other people that your doctrines are right, persuading other people that your methods are right, getting stuff done, making the trains run on time, evaluating our leaders and evaluating our members in terms of numbers and results and productivity, instead of love and compassion and humility and faithfulness. You know, you see this in things as trivial as the sports world. Nobody's ever happy with just watching an athlete or an entertainer or something do something that they enjoy watching. It's always got to be rating and comparison. Oh, Lopez made a great play. Do you think he's as good as Davy Concepcion was at that play? Oh, no, Davy Concepcion made that play far better than Lopez did. And it's the end of the game. The Mammoths are the champions. They've won the championship. Fred, do you think the Mammoths are as great a team as the 1945 Brontosauruses were? Well, the Mammoths are a great team, but I think the Brontosauruses could have taken them in a short series. I think the Brontosauruses were really better. Let's ask our studio analyst, Rex. Well, I disagree with both of you. The Mammoths and the Brontosauruses were both good, but I think the 1982 Sparrows were the best of all. And actually, I think, really, now that I think of it, the 1996 Squid could have strangled either of these teams. Well, now, Rex, I don't think you're right at all. I think the Mammoths are a really great team, and you shouldn't underrate them and disrespect them like this. Nobody can just sit back and appreciate things for what they are. It's always got to be, is this the greatest team? Is he the greatest player? Is he the greatest singer? Is this the greatest movie? Is my favorite movie the greatest movie? No, my favorite movie is the greatest movie. It's so silly. And it's even sillier in Christianity, but it's sadder in Christianity, that we have to rate and evaluate what people are doing instead of just look at everybody as a Gaius who's doing something wonderful and who's doing something to show his love or her love and compassion for other people, and just rejoice in that. Say, that brother is doing something that encourages me. And instead of telling other people, you know, you could be more involved in this. Why weren't you at that activity? You know, we had a great time doing this. Where were you? You missed out. Instead of saying that, you know, it takes a little more effort to look into someone's life to find what they are doing. Sister, that's really great that you're doing that. I really appreciate you doing that. I really appreciate the way that you're encouraging people or your faithfulness in some way. You can always find stuff in anyone who's following God. And all the difference is that if you just adjust your mind to think the best of other people instead of thinking the worst. You know, for example, see, I know, I've found out that there are people who use their little electronic gizmos to cheat on these trivia questions. Now, I could assume that these people are motivated by a desire to look good and look smart even when they're not. But I assume, I apply the principle of grace, I assume that people see these questions and they're just so eager to learn, they're just so excited about understanding the world a little bit better that they just can't wait for the answer. I assume the best.
That's it.
I didn't mention any names, but I wonder if we can figure out who some of the people using their electronic gizmos are. But see, that's the thing, is if you just assume about a brother or sister, well, maybe it looks to me as if they're slacking off and not doing anything. Maybe if you look beneath the surface, maybe you'll find that the things going on in their life, for what's going on with them, maybe they're really giving an awful lot. Maybe they're like that widow tossed those two little coins. You know, a passage that we love to read and hate to apply. You know, we love to read that, but we hate to apply it because most of us would think the same thing of the widows. 2 cents, hey, our budget's $5,000 a week. What's going on with the 2 cents? And the same thing is true in non-numerical ways too. You just show up on Sunday morning and you're not part of any of these great activities we have planned for you. What's the deal here? Well, you don't know what's going on in their life. You don't know what else they're doing. You don't know how else they're giving. You don't know who they're encouraging. You don't know what kind of sacrifices they may have to make. You don't know what hardships they struggle with. We just don't know. We just can't pass judgment on each other. Well, rather than leave it at this character diatrophies, I'll point out that there's some ironies here, by the way, in the way that he's treating John. Because if you go back to the book of Mark, John and his brother James had a nickname in Mark 3:17. The Sons of Thunder. And there's this incident in Luke chapter 9 where there's this village that Jesus was preaching in, and they kind of dumped on Jesus and didn't want him around. And remember what John and James said?
Let's call down on fire.
Let's blast these guys, man. Let's call down some fire from heaven. And then in Mark 10, you'll see this incident where John and his brother came up to Jesus and asked him for something. Remember what they wanted? Can we be your two greatest guys in heaven? Can we be at your right and left in heaven? See, what did John love when he was young and immature in Christ? He loved to be first too. There's kind of a sad irony that now that he's really learned the right way to follow things, now he's getting shoved around and slandered by someone else who loves to be first. And the reason why I meant that out is, if you know in your heart that you struggle with competition and comparisons and controlling other people, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you're a human being. If you struggle trying to control other people, if you worry about trying to make other people think the things you do and do the things you do, it just means you're a human being. It doesn't mean you start all over again and be baptized all over again or anything silly like that. It just means to learn to be a little bit more humble and learn that we all really need to learn to put each other first and to put Jesus first of all. That's all that it means. There again, as I say, people who love to be first, we're not called to judge them and shun them any more than we're called to judge and shun people who commit any other sin. It's something to be gracious to, something to be patient with. A lot of people are like that. They do cause harm. They do cause damage, as any sin does. But there again, it's something that all of us struggle with in some way. And if we're humble with each other, if we're honest with each other, we can help each other instead of making it worse. Picking up in verse 11, third John chapter 1, verse 11. I'll just read this. It says, "Dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone and even by the truth itself." We also speak well of him, and we know that our testimony is true. And I wrote this other scripture, but look it up when you get a chance, 1 John 3. It's a parallel passage that kind of discusses this idea a little bit more at length, and that it talks about here in verse 11. It talks about the source of good. Now this phrase that he has, "Everyone who does what is good is from God, and everyone who does what is evil is not from God." That's the kind of phrase that our little forensic minds tend to really mess up, tend to really get our microscopes out and our Greek dictionaries out and really make a pig's breakfast out of it. Because it doesn't mean that you can point at someone and say, "He did something wrong, he's not from God. He did something right, he's from God, I think he's perfect." The reality is, as John well knows, John didn't just show up in town a couple days ago. Everybody does good things and everybody does bad things. Everybody has done some wonderful things and everyone has done some harmful things. What John is saying is not to go out there and rate and evaluate people and decide who's from God and who's not. What he's saying is, what does he want Gaius to do? Verse 11. Don't imitate what's evil, but imitate what's good. Because where does good come from? This is what he's saying. The source of good is Jesus, is God. That Jesus and God are the only source that allows us to do something that's truly good and truly beneficial for other people. And this is what he's calling on his friend to realize. You look at Demetrius, he's doing stuff that's good. Well, the reason he's doing stuff that's good is because of his faithfulness to God. And this character, Diotrephes, why is he doing these evil things? Well, he's giving into his fleshly nature. He's being influenced by Satan. His flesh is too weak. And so he's calling Gaius, rather than judging people, he's calling on him to just imitate what's good because the good is from God. And since we're out of time, short on time, 1 John 3, 7 to 10 gives you a different perspective on that. Because again, you see, there are many ways to give. And he has this really nice phrase about this guy, Demetrius. He says that it's not just me that speaks well of him. Who else speaks well of this guy Demetrius? It's really interesting. It says the truth itself speaks well of Demetrius. What's that mean? The truth speaks well of him. What does it mean? Well, it means that if you were to take a look at Demetrius, you would say, yeah, there's a guy who's living what he believes. There's a God who's doing what? Walking in the light, walking in the truth. The truth speaks well of him. Following the values of the gospel, following the light, like the Arctic Tern, doing whatever it takes to seek that light and live in that sunlight. And you see, the thing about it is that Demetrius here is doing some things that John's very encouraged by. What is Demetrius doing that's so great? We have no idea. It doesn't say, does it? Doesn't say. See, Phil doesn't even come to class that often. He's always already on to my trick questions here. It doesn't say. Why doesn't it say? I mean, wouldn't it have been a good example? We should know what Demetrius is doing. I want to have the truth speak well of me. What is he doing? What is he visiting lots of people in the hospital? Is that what he's doing? I bet he's evangelizing lots of people. He's probably baptized all kinds of people this year. What is he doing? Oh, he's going and refuting all these people with their false doctrines. I bet he's proved definitively that we can't use organs in church. That's great. What do I need to do? Well, it doesn't say, does it? Because it doesn't matter. If it were important, it would say it. It doesn't say it because it doesn't matter. All we know is that Demetrius, like Gaius, has done what? He's found a way to help other people to see God. Whether it's he's found a way to help people to see God's love a little bit better, maybe he's found people to help God see God's truth a little bit better, maybe he's helped people to see God's justice a little bit better. We don't know what it is, and it's not important. Because again, what is he encouraging Gaius to do? Imitate what's good. Find something good to do. Don't wait for someone else to tell you what to do. See, it kind of goes both ways. The fact that we tend naturally to think of the church as an institution distorts things in two ways, because on the one hand, everyone sits around and waits to be told what to do. And then you get leaders who cater to that and start bossing people around and say, you should have been there, why weren't you there? We're going to do this, everyone needs to do this. Try to put everyone in the same box, trying to force everyone into the same mold. But see, that also leads to people in the church then not being willing to just see something on their own. We lose our spiritual initiative. And what he's talking about is there are just so many ways that you can show people God. And it's something that instead of making it hard for each other, we just make a little easier on each other by doing exactly what John's doing. Sit down with your friend Gaius. You see Gaius inviting missionaries over to lunch? Doesn't have to be missionaries. Maybe you see Gaius just inviting another church member over for lunch and show him that he cares about it. Let Gaius know that you appreciate that. Maybe Gaius has just stopped by and patted you on the back and encouraged you at a time when you weren't feeling good. Let Gaius know that it helped a little bit. Don't wait until you find someone that does something dramatic before you get all excited about it. That's the world's point of view. The world needs something forceful and dramatic. But Jesus just needs something that shows people that light a little bit more. Remember what Jesus said, anyone who gives you so much as a cup of water in my name, well, that's a good start, but why aren't they out evangelizing people more? Anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name, that's good. Sit them down and teach them all the proper doctrines so that they can do more good in the church. Now, did I quote that scripture correctly?
Yeah.
Now, if you give someone a cup of water, you're not going to lose your reward to Jesus. Well, you see, that's what Jesus wants. There are plenty of people who just need a little cup of water. They don't need some dramatic example. They don't need for you to sit down and straighten out all the things that they're wrong about. They just need you to give them a cup of water. And Jesus says you won't lose your reward. Jesus never says you got to be a big shot. You got to be a Diotrephes to be rewarded by God. He says you just give someone a cup of water. There's lots and lots of things you could do out there. That's Christian friendship and Christian fellowship. I'm going to read the rest of this. And Ray, can you get John 15, this verse up here, John 15, 14 and 15 ready? I'm going to read the end of 3 John, and then if you could read that for us. This is just the closing of the letter, and that way, if I don't get done with anything else, at least I can say we read the whole book of 3 John. Verse 13, I have much to write you, but I do not want to do so with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face. Peace to you. The friends here send their greetings. Greet the friends there by name.
Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father I have made known to you.
Jesus even uses that word friend. He tells his own disciples, that was at the Last Supper, we studied it in the John class several weeks ago, Because I don't want to call you my servants. I want you to be my friends. Just like John and Gaius. I want to be friends. You know that being a friend of Jesus is a little different than being a friend of some other random person. There's a side to it where he is the Lord and Master. That's understood. It's what he says in that passage in John. He wants you to know what's going on. He doesn't want to just boss you around. He wants you to understand. He wants you to see his Father. He wants you to understand what his Father's really like. And you know, John, here at the end of the letter, he has this simple exchange of greetings in this exchange of letters. And it's interesting what he says. And he closes 2 John the same way. Verse 12, I have much to write you, but I don't want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to do what? Yeah, again, think of John, old apostle, been on the job a long time. He's probably got a lot of responsibilities, but what does he want to spend some time doing? Thinking of Gaius, writing a letter to Gaius. Man, I wish I could see old Gaius someday. That's what he'd like to do. Because, see, Christian friendship, even though there's a lot of differences and responsibilities that aren't part of worldly friendships, still, a friendship is by definition personal. Our relationship with God is by definition personal. Jesus always told us, I want you to know God. I want you to be with God. And that always should be at the forefront, the personal choices that we've made to follow Jesus, the personal needs we have that we can help each other with, being a community, being a family. And as Jesus said in that passage in John, to be true friends, true friends, not worldly friends. Not worldly friends who just compete with each other or goad one another into doing foolish things, but true friends who encourage each other in a genuine way and look out for each other. Little science trivia for you. Gave all of you plenty of a chance to lift this thing up if you have one of those gadgets. Our word electricity comes from the ancient Greek word electron. Or as I've spelled it on the board for those of you who enjoy this kind of thing. Well, the question is, what did the word electron mean in ancient Greek? Metal, thread, river, amber, or frog? Who thinks that the word electricity comes from the ancient Greek word for metal? How about thread? How about river? How about amber? How about frog? Well, it helps if you know the first person known to have discovered and written about electricity. Ben Franklin, right? No, it wasn't Ben Franklin. People have known about electricity for hundreds of years before Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin is credited because he's an American and we like for everything important to have been discovered by Americans. So we talk about Ben Franklin and Thomas Edison as if they had just invented electricity and figured it all out for themselves. In reality, electricity had been around for a long, long time. One of the reasons why Ben Franklin was able to make some scientific observations is because there was a scientist in the 1700s in Italy named Luigi Galvani who'd done a great many experiments about electricity, which is why I put... He used frogs. He had made experiments on dead frogs with the electrical impulses that their muscles can send. But that's not the answer, so if you guessed E, don't get too smug just yet, because that's not the answer either. The word electricity in English goes back farther than that. There's a scientist named William Gilbert, who's not the same William Gilbert who wrote the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. Scientist in the 1500s, William Gilbert, who invented the word electricity and who wrote about what he called electric force and electric attraction, he got the word from an old Greek scientist named Thales in about 600 BC. This old Greek philosopher and scientist named Thales wrote about electricity, and he was writing to investigate things he had gotten from even more ancient sources from other cultures around the world. And the experiment that Thales did, he's the first known person individual to write about electricity, but he got his information from elsewhere too. His experiment, he wrote about what we call static electricity. And his first experiment was he took a cloth and rubbed it on a piece of amber, and it produced what we call static electricity. Then after he touched that piece of cloth, he got a little spark. And so William Gilbert in 1600, about AD 1600, the word electron means amber in Greek. And so he named electricity after amber. which is a connection you would never guess unless you had studied the history of science or unless you cheated on your little gadget or something like that. Now see, my point is, we like our history and we like our science to be nice and convenient and categorized and give credit. Give credit where we think credit is due. Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, thanks to them we got all this electricity in the world. Well, no, it's not. They were, as Isaac Newton himself said, standing on the shoulders of giants. There's no such thing as any human being who can fix all the problems of the world or even one real problem in the world. We all have to work together, even if it's with people who are now dead and who tried to tackle the same problem and made a little bit of progress that you can build on. That's true of anything that's worthwhile. And it's very true in the church. We're not supposed to be like old Diotrephes, trying to be first, grab credit, worrying about whether our church can take credit for something that happened or whether we have to share credit, controlling and competing with one another. We don't need to worry about that because Christianity, especially, is far too much bigger than we are. It's one thing to look at electricity, a powerful and unusual natural force that it took many brilliant men hundreds of years just to make little bits of progress to understand. The gospel is far more profound than electricity. It's far more challenging to the fleshly nature that loves competition and controlling and credit and competing. And so we really do have to humble ourselves and work as friends and as caring brothers and sisters if we want to help truly glorify God in ways that truly please Him instead of ways that just please our flesh. Thank you very much for your patient attention. Next week we'll start the new class when everyone is back from the holiday. Thanks a lot.